folks, we're back on the flagstick.com T-Talk podcast. Stefan Tiedorf here with my co-host Scott McLeod. Scotty, how are you?
Well, I'm getting through the week. How's that? Had a nice birthday day yesterday. Heard from a lot of people, which was kind of nice, including yourself. Thank you for those wishes for my 75th birthday. I really appreciate that. But yeah, otherwise, all right.
Yeah, 50 plus a couple.
You know? Sure, we'll go with that.
Yeah, 50 plus a couple. Yeah, happy birthday.
Thank you.
To the heartbeat of Flagstick, as many have highlighted. And, you know, I think you don't like compliments, but when a lot of compliments of the nicest guy in Canadian golf, I think that's very fair to almost a fault for you at times.
Yeah, you know what? Here's the thing.
That's how you end up with the podcast with me. That's how nice.
Yeah, that was
2 years later. You still haven't figured out how to get out of it.
What was nice and what was funny was had one friend reach out and said, "Oh man, I can't believe like Twitter was blowing up and whatever." And I said to her, "The older you get, the more people you can pile in your life, and that's the only reason why, or whatever." But yeah, it was great to hear from a lot of people. Yesterday always is. It's always nice. And that's all it is.
Yeah, you wish you could do it more, but you know, it'd be impossible. So hey, you got a good day, good food. Hopefully you had time for a nice beverage or two, and back on the grind this week. A lot of golf to talk about. How much of the Farmers did you get to watch? I think it was a tournament. I think so far is the one that I've tuned in the most of. I said I was going to because of that Wednesday to Saturday, and yeah, it really allowed for it, where like it wasn't this like rush on Sunday. It was like very weird. Like Sunday felt relaxing to me. I know they'll never change it, but how about you? Did you get to watch more because of the change?
Yeah, it was just kind of weird with the final being on Saturday, which was kind of nice. But I certainly watched more than I expected to watch. And the Wednesday start was obviously nice too. It was just confusing more than anything, but I think it was good because, you know, everybody wanted to watch the football, or a lot of people wanted to watch the football and see what was going on there. At the same time, you know, watching some of the LPGA stuff, but knowing that it was a final on the Saturday, and whatever you were going to write or talk about or anything of that tournament concluded, you could take care of it then. Whereas it's really difficult sometimes on Sunday nights because so many sports happen on a Sunday, especially when you have things on the West Coast. And it's not like I'm writing recaps and stuff of things that are happening, but you're paying attention to, you know, what the Canadians are doing or whatever. And you might be sending out some social media stuff or whatever. And for that not to have to happen on Sunday night was a bit of a blessing for sure.
Yeah, I thought it was going to get real busy early on Saturday when Taylor Pendrith came out. And now he was one back at that point of the lead. And it was like, okay, here we go. Like, and I'd sprinkled a couple dollars on because they were giving insane. He's 2-3 back of the lead going into Sunday, and you were getting like 10,000 for me to win. It's like, I'll throw $5 on that.
Sure, why not?
Comes out birdie. I was like writing him into my will. Like I was like, thank you. So unfortunately didn't get done, but another T16 for him. So a solid week overall at the Farmers. And let's start talking about it. Let's start talking about the week that was. There's a bunch of different golf tournaments happening and a bunch of different stuff happening. So where's your birdie for the week? Let's start off with some birdies.
Well, I mean, the other thing that was happening obviously was the DP World Tour, European Tour was on, which, you know, really makes these weeks right now really intense as far as the golf, because it starts first thing in the morning and it goes all the way through to the end of the night. It's the best for us. Spouses may not think the same way. They're probably like, what, golf still on? Like, you know, it's 14 hours later. But, you know, Victor Hovland winning over in Dubai, picked up his second European Tour title. You know, dude's only been a pro for 2.5 years or so, already won 3 times on the PGA Tour. And, you know, I just love kind of his attitude of how he goes about doing things. And, you know, he's confident, but he just always seems shocked that he's actually won, which is kind of amazing. I hope he doesn't lose that, really. I mean, it's the gosh shucks, I can't believe this has happened, but it was good to see. I mean, an immense talent, you know, has moved up to number 3 in the world and, you know, has gathered a lot of world ranking points in a very short period of time.
Yeah, him and Colin Morikawa came out of school at the same time, and couple of years, and here we are, second, third world rankings. It's some see. I agree with you on Viktor Hovland. He's just such an easy guy to root for. You know, that oh shucks, you know, I'm just happy to be here type of guy. But that was quite a field, and right to the end, and obviously Rory hits that one into the water, and you can question his decision making. But I saw this great, you know, this great tweet, people are going on about him hitting that ball in the water and, you know, what was he thinking, yada, yada, yada. And people are like, it's the, I don't even know the name, the Dubai Classic, that Sync.io Dubai.
Sync.io, yeah. Sync.io, yeah.
Exactly. I think Rory's going to get over it. And that Rory said to us last year that, like, I'm going to be me. Me is enough. And that is what got Rory into four majors in that quick span, and all those career wins was him being that aggressive player throughout his career. He's not going to change that. And ultimately it didn't get done. He finishes one short of the playoff, and Viktor Hovland goes out with my boy, Dick Bland, and Viktor Hovland gets the job done. But like Terrell was up there, or Terrell, Erik van Rooyen's up, Bam Scott was in the mix. You know, it was a good leaderboard over there at the DP World Tour Sync.io Dubai Desert Classic.
just say on the European Tour this week. That's good enough.
Yeah, yeah, it was a lot, but yeah, I agree with you on that. You did mention the LPGA earlier. My birdie this week doesn't go to the tournament. I actually didn't have a chance to watch it. I was too deep into football on Sunday and preparing for that, and a 7-layer dip that spent me 2 hours to make and was very delicious. But
how was the nap afterwards?
Not many naps that day, probably a little too many beers on a Sunday afternoon with my friends in my 30s that Monday was a little sluggish. But the LPGA has announced they're doing this all access doc. You had a great tweet about it. This is something that we've been asking for. The PGA Tour is doing their Netflix series, obviously, but like, let's show these LPGA personalities that don't get that same exposure. They don't get it on social media as much. They don't get it, you know, they just don't have that big of an audience. These are these little things that can get that exposure out there. Obviously, they're going to showcase the big names in there. What else are you hearing about it? Launch dates, things along those lines.
Yeah.
That excite you, I guess.
Yeah, well, the first episode is already out on YouTube. Just came out yesterday. Picked up about 17,000 views so far, and they've got another one that's coming out, I believe, tomorrow. So they're issuing these out in small segments or whatever. You know what? Any exposure that they can have is going to be great for the tour. And the fact that they can go and, you know, work with the players, because that's one of the things, the LPGA Tour players get it. They realize that, you know, they have to do some extra things to get the attention that one they deserve, which is unfortunate, but they're willing to do that, whether it's extra autograph stuff or extra media work or whatever the case may be. I mean, you know, we talked about it last week, a player saying they'd go and wash dishes if they get a $1 million purse or whatever. I haven't watched this yet, but I'm excited to see it just because of the fact I know, you know, from experience of being around those tournaments and what great storylines there actually are, that finally gets shared with the public. And too often, you know, everybody just gets caught up in PGA Tour. It's a behemoth. I mean, it's got a machine that promotes this worldwide, that it becomes the number one stopover for every amateur to talk about golf, and it's all relative to the PGA Tour. So I think if they get to see this, get to know the personalities, get to know and understand the players beyond the top 10, which is really important. And on the other side of it as well, it really dives into the other side of it, of getting to know people beyond what they think they are. And this deals a lot with some of the issues that have happened with the LPGA Tour over the years, where people will sort of, you know, pigeonhole, hey, there's these 30 Korean players and they're all the same. You know, that's pretty bad, but this will start to show people that every single player has their own personality, and no matter where they're from, they've got something to contribute to this tour.
Yeah, I think it's great. If only thing, hey, it's going to get more viewers on, which hopefully means more money to the tour. I'm looking forward to it. Episode one out now. It's on my tab for once we finish recording here. I'll be watching it. First episode's only 18 minutes. These are the things, the type of material you can throw through size. Really quick.
Second one's 20 minutes. So, yeah.
There we go. What's your bogey for the week, Scotty?
My bogey for the week, Will Zalatoris. I mean, obviously, just heard that he's contracted COVID-19, so he's not going to be in the field this week.
I thought
week
they weren't
up.
Testing anymore.
Well, they may not be testing, but I don't know where the protocol came from. It could have came from some other situation that is not related to the tour. Whatever the case may be, he's not going to be in the field this week. Even if they weren't testing, maybe he just doesn't feel well. That could be the case as well.
Hopefully not the case.
Yeah, but whatever the case may be, I mean, his ball striking was exceptional at the Farmers. I mean, he just was fantastic in what he did and how he got around the golf course. The issue, obviously, as everybody watched, the putting stroke, little shaky. In fact, you know, he was 122nd in strokes gained putting last year. What I'm interested in is, you know, is this going to be the difference maker for this player? I mean, we had suspected that, you know, the way he came out last year, that he was going to get a win right away. A lot of people thought he would, obviously hasn't. We're going to wonder, is the putter going to be the difference for him? Is he going to ever overcome that? Is he going to play so well with his ball striking that he can, you know, putt poorly and still get a win? So my bogey to him is just, you know, a bogey in general to his putting, really.
Yeah, I have a question for you, though. With sure. that, how many bad strokes have been made in contention that we haven't even seen because they haven't been that zoomed in, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think everybody sees that and they go, oh, that is gross. That's awful. And if they saw their own putting stroke, the amount of motion, mm-hmm. the amount of times you miss the center of the face is insane amount.
Yeah.
Like from a coaching standpoint, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you probably see this all the time. Like, is it as bad as we think it is? Or, I mean, you're looking at the data here. It's like, you know, it's not that great, but there are a bunch of other people that haven't shown up that zoomed in that, you know, it could be a number of different things.
Yeah, I think, well, that just sort of accentuates it to the public and gives it that perception. And that's why I looked at the strokes gained rather than looking at just the stroke itself. I mean, first mm-hmm. off, anybody that was looking at it and seeing the path of a stroke, the path of the stroke contributes a small portion as far as where the ball starts. Right. I mean, it's probably Dave Powell's measured and said, you know, 17%. So it's the face angle that's the difference. As far as the contact point, yeah, you know what? There's lots of players that very untraditional as far as their putting is concerned. They can
Brooks Koepka hits it off the toe on purpose every time.
Exactly. And there's all these situations. It's basically them finding out what their tendencies are, using those tendencies and matching them to the golf course. That's really the secret more than anything. I mean, everybody's going to have variance. It doesn't matter how good the player is in their golf swing and their putting stroke or whatever. So when I look at it, I don't look at it physically from the stroke itself. I look at it from the data, you know, and that's where it jumps out to me that obviously, you know, he's not doing what he can on the greens. And what is the purpose that you can have that exact same stroke? It might be his reads, you know, there's a lot of different factors that you can't control. I've coached lots of different putting clinics. One of the first things that I go through with people is things you can control and things you can't control. So you can put the most amazing stroke on it, but if, you know, something happens with the greens being bumpy, there's lots of different other factors, you can't make that putt. If you make a great stroke, but you read it poorly, well, you're not going to hit it in the hole. That's just the way it is. So I look at it this way. Yeah, it comes down to where he's standing with his strokes gained versus his actual physical stroke itself, which just everybody seems to think, and I saw it in particular, some media people, younger media people in you know, working for larger publications that are supposed to be doing instruction stuff, and they just openly criticized it without, you know, digging into it more than anything.
Yeah, that's why when I saw it, everyone's chirping it. We actually have a question in our mailbag we'll get to of like, who would you have do all your putts, right? And I'm going to answer it correctly, but I thought, if I had Will Zalatoris hit all my putts, I would be the best putter around anybody on the air.
Yeah,
always. But people don't think that. They see that putt and they're like, oh, this guy's horrible. He can't putt. It's ruining his career. No, it's not ruining his career. No. Just finished second. He'll be fine. He'll probably pick up wins.
And that's why the stroke gained numbers are important, because they're in comparison to what their peers are doing. And that's really the most important part. I mean, really, when it comes down to it, as far as the math is concerned, you know, you have to beat other players. You don't necessarily have to beat the golf course. You just have to be better than the other players. The person that wins is the one who puts it all together during the week. So as you said, you know, you could take your swings all you want and match his putting to it, and I bet your handicap would drop.
Exactly. Oh, it better. Yeah. My bogey for the week goes to Brooks Koepka. It's not for Brooks. All right. It's about Brooks. Okay. And this is very loose that Brooks is doing. I think what Brooks is doing right now, I'm not giving him a negative, but I'm giving a bogey to everyone that's counting Brooks Koepka out. He just made the cut. He dyed his hair blonde. He's supposed to, I think he's getting married this year, if I'm not mistaken. Like, there's all these, what people are viewing as distractions from Brooks Koepka. And the usual takes are coming out that he's not taking it too seriously. Yada, 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 blah, blah, blah. Like, look at how bad the start is. He's only had one top 10 this year. He's missed a couple cuts. How much money do you think Brooks Koepka made last year on the golf course?
A lot. I'm going to say on the golf course.
He only had one win.
Just on PGA Tour?
Just on the PGA Tour. He had one win last year, and that was the Waste Management, I believe. Yes.
$5 million.
Yeah, made $5 million last year. You know what he did in his first six starts? He missed the cut three times.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? Like, and yeah. People, he missed the cut six times last year. Like, people think.
Well, we've said it before. I mean, players will generally make most of their money in 6 or 7 weeks.
Yeah. But like, Brooks Koepka, this is just what this guy does, right? He, in a couple of years ago, he made $9 million on the PGA Tour. He didn't even win the Tour Championship somehow. He came in third, right? Like, I think people, I'm giving a bogey to anyone that's underestimating this guy. If this guy could come out and win two majors this year, and nobody should be shocked. Like, I feel like we underestimate one of the best players of our generation. We've talked about over and over. I'm just giving a bogey to us, constantly underestimating one of the best players in the world. And I feel like he's playing a game on us with the blonde hair, with all this stuff. Brooks Koepka does not care. He missed the cut at the Farmers Insurance at all.
He's like he's the duck of the PGA Tour. He looks like he's doing something on the surface, but underneath he's paddling like hell, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think that's a perfect analogy. So I'm giving a bogey, not to Brooks. I don't care if you look like Eminem. And hopefully that comes out before your wedding later this year. But for everyone counting him out, for all the bad Brooks takes, all of that, settle down. Go look at last year. Look at the start of last year. Couple early top tens, bunch of missed cuts. Odds go way up to 50-1 at the Waste Management, which he never gets. People hammer it. What happens? He wins, right? Like, watch out for Brooks Koepka this year. Done with the bad takes on him. What's your par for the week?
My par for the week goes to Lydia Ko. Obviously, gets a win. That's her 17th win. I'm giving this a par because, you know, really, is anyone really surprised? I mean, you know, obviously she went through a little bit of turmoil, swing changes, coach changes, lots of different things happening there. But it's not easy to win on tour. It's not easy to do this. I mean, she's the, you know, first player under the age of 25 since Nancy Lopez to get this many wins at that age. But it feels like she just doesn't make a lot of mistakes. And we've talked about her lots here. We keep saying, you know, watch out for Lydia Ko, watch out for Lydia Ko. It's just a tidy game, and I'm never surprised by what she does. And, you know, frankly, one win, I could see a couple more this year. And we talked about Kang last week and said she could run the tables too. And she was obviously in the mix. I just give this a par more or less because this is what I expect of her more than anything.
It's so weird to say that, hey, I'm giving a par for somebody that won a golf tournament because she should win. Like, that's how good
I know
she's been forever. Just funny to think. I'm going a little different with my par for this week. I saw this article today, and it was based on CNN, and this guy named Neil Watts, who is claiming, he's an amateur golfer, he's played for 30 years. He is claiming that in the last 12 or the last 7 months, he has 12 hole-in-ones. Wow. Did you see this? It's on CNN.
Yeah.
It's just like,
those odds are unbelievable.
The odds are insane. It's kind of a cool story, but it's one of these stories where, like, I'll just believe you. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, there's, it's just like this weird story of like, that's really cool if it happened. It'd be cool if it was on camera and like things along those. Like, we're just taking your word for it at this point. I'm going to assume, let's assume it's real. I just saw this article and I was just like, I didn't have a reaction either way. I just kind of said, okay. Like, I don't know what to do with it. Like,
yeah.
Like, what are your thoughts? Like, well, if we have that, it's pure luck, obviously, yeah. But also, if you didn't and you're doing it, why, you know, I'm just in this weird state.
I don't know. I mean, I always wonder about that. I won't get into it in particular, but we've had some golfers, you know, report a vast amount of hole-in-ones over the years, you know, claiming witnesses and things like that. I can see that certainly some of them, it's a little questionable because you wonder, okay, did they get all this attention from, you know, maybe they got two hole-in-ones and they thought, oh, this is really cool. Maybe they're really aggressive and they go at every hole. Maybe they play a lot of little par three courses. I mean, it's hard to know. And, you know, frankly, given the odds, it's very difficult to think that it's actually happening. There are players that, you know, have verified that, you know, they've had large quantities, much more than this, but that many in that short period of time is really, really hard to fathom. It really is.
It's insane. So I just like, it is what it is. It's par. I don't know what to say about it. It's just weird to me. If it's real, cool. If it's not, cool.
Not cool. That's, if it's not cool.
Really. Exactly. So that's,
I mean, you get to the point where it's got to be hard that, you know, if you have done that,
yeah, no, that, who's believing you at one?
That's point? The problem, right? And yeah. It's so miraculous that, you know, because frankly, I've had some decent shots in my life where I said, hey, I made a two on that par four. I can remember it happening when I was a teenager and people are like, really? You know. So, I mean, that's one shot, which is really could happen. Now, if I said, oh, it happened four holes in a row, or wow, I hold out for eagle, you know, 12 times in 7 months. That gets a little dodgy. So yeah, good for him if it did happen, but if it didn't, dude, get a life.
Yeah. What's your honorable mention for the week?
Birdie for me, about the 18th hole at Torrey Pines South. A lot of discussion always about this golf course. You know, obviously it's got the great vistas over on the one side, but office buildings on the other. But you know, in hosting US Opens, this course is always delivered. The 18th hole itself always seems to deliver some sort of story, some sort of drama, whether it's, you know, somebody hitting the cabbage has to pitch out, they spin it off the green, or they hit the flag, or they go for it in two, that's or the, hit it over the back.
Spinning off the green is such a cool note, because it's like, I go for it in two, I'm probably going off the back. The wedge shot's not easy.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's the, and, you know, going back to last week's conversation about par fives and Yaz Links and Tyrrell Hatton or whatever. I mean, that's the thing. That's what a par five is supposed to do. It's supposed to challenge you on all these different shots. And it's the whole puzzle of it, of how to play it, that makes it more fascinating than a par three or a par four in some cases, because there are many different facets to it. So I think that as a result, you know, it always seems to provide some sort of drama, somebody going for it, some weird chip out, some wild putt, you know, so just a birdie to that hole in general. You know, would I want to see them play it 72 times in a tournament? Probably not, but that could be fun.
I think it is a great hole. I think it gets, you know, people get mad of it because it's got that fake pond in the front. When you got the ocean there, it's like, you know, it's nowhere near the ocean realistically. You can see it in the background, whatever.
Yeah.
Cool hole. I think it does exactly what it's supposed to do, and why they go back there every single year. It provides drama on the last hole. It did in the, you know, this week, it did in the US Open. There's always something that goes on at that hole. So I agree with you. My honorable mention, I'm giving a nap. The word nap. I'm giving a nap to the four caddies that are sharing a room at Pebble
Beach. I saw that.
Our guy Kyle Peters is sharing a room where it's a room with four cots in it, with Gino Benelli, Dave Stone, Kyle Peters, and I believe Zach Smith.
Oh, Stoner's in there too. Nice.
Yeah, I believe
Zach, the Canadian.
Yeah, Zach Smith is the fourth there. I did some research. Yeah. So for anyone that's that caddies on the PGA Tour, the PGA Tour does a great job with their caddy master of finding deals on lodging, parking, all the information you need, where to get everything. It's all, there's a website for it. Their deals in quotation marks for this tournament of what they're recommending to stay with pricing. A lodge at Pebble Beach ranges anywhere from $990 to $1,500 per night.
Why do they even have that in the document?
I know, per night. And then the inn at Spanish Bay is around $1,000 per night. So what you're seeing there, I haven't confirmed this with Kyle, but I am guessing that four guys or whatever room they're sharing are probably spending around $250 US per night to sleep on a cot right beside their buddy, no TV in the room, nothing, just to sleep there so they can do their job each week. They're going to be tired. Hopefully none of them are snorers in that room. I would not be welcome in that room, that's for sure.
No.
With my snoring. So I feel bad for them, but that's it. You know, there's the luxury of professional golf and being caddies out there. And then there's, yeah, four guys sharing a room just to get by.
I always love the thing for the caddies, especially for the guys that are, you know, four guys in a room or whatever, where they, you know, they have two beds, there's floor spots, and it's basically comes down to the score on the day where the two high scores get the floor, yeah, you know, which is kind of fun. I think somebody pointed out where they're at, and it's actually some other inn down the way. So they might be saving a few more dollars, but that just shows you, though, there's very limited options around there as far as where you can stay. It's a high price zone. And yeah, I mean, they'll be hoping that somebody gets the win this week, that's for sure.
Yeah, this is one where you get back, if you're on the morning stretch and the couple guys in the afternoon, you just go to bed then. Just to get a couple extra naps during the day, which is unfortunate because you're in one of the most beautiful parts of the United States. But hey, it's expensive. I did see, though, they have a Chipotle in the dining for the caddies.
Oh, really? Wow.
Right in the dining for caddy.
Wow.
Dining. That's pretty sweet.
That's pretty incredible, because half the time they have nothing for food.
Yeah. A little bit different than the Greenbrier. I think we got hot dogs and who knows what.
I still remember one year at the Turning Stone event. It would have been about 2009 or so. And I was just hanging out, chat with a bunch of players, doing some interviews and stuff like that. And then I think it was Michael Allen's caddy. And I wanted to talk to him about something. That's what it was. They had a TV that was embedded. It was the first TV that was embedded
in the golf bag.
Yeah. So it was, you know, to advertise. And it was one of Michael Allen's friends that had this. And really, I mean, it was a screen for sponsors and stuff like that. So I wanted to talk to the caddy, and I was going to look at it. And he's like, "Oh, come on down here. We got our food, you know, where we're eating or whatever. I'll come down where the bags are or whatever. And we've got our caddy spot down there." So I literally go down underneath the clubhouse into the pit where all the carts were. There are literally 4x8 plastic tables set up with like a pot of chili, a few crusty looking sandwiches that I don't know where they came from or whatever. And this was basically the caddy dining situation. So, and it literally, it was a terrible weather out. And there was no doorway to go into this place, and the wind was like whipping through it. And it was probably like 45 degrees in there, maybe at best. And they actually said it was decent. So
yeah, that's embarrassing. They've had worse. Especially those old caddies, you know, have been around where, you know, they weren't even allowed on the grounds. There wasn't food for you. You were getting whatever you were eating the snacks if you could in between. But that was the week that was. Why don't we hit our interview for this week, Scotty? I was able to sit down with David Gaylord from Bushbaum. He's the CEO and co-founder, but also former Division I golfer. We had him come on here to chat about, you know, starting a business, but also like the importance of golf and how golf taught him how to do a bunch of different things in business and how it still influences the decisions he makes today. So without further ado, why don't we head over to Ottawa, Ontario, where we chatted with David Gaylord from Bushbaum.
All
All right, folks, we'd like to welcome to the podcast CEO and one of the co-founders of Bush Bomb, a good golfer in his day as a former D1 athlete, now just plays for fun while working on his business, David Gaylord. How are you today, Ben?
Hey, very good. Pumped to chat with you. It's been a while, actually, Stefan.
Yeah, so we've been good friends. We've worked together for a long time, played a little golf together, but we're not here to talk about my golf game. They get to hear about that awfulness every single day. You you grew up in the area playing a lot of junior golf and eventually went to play down in the States. Why don't you just talk about that experience? Because I know you're super passionate about, you know, the ability to play at that higher level and just experiencing a different world outside of, you know, what you're used to as a junior golfer.
Yeah, for sure. So I grew up in Tweed, Ontario. So it's like a town of 1,200 or 2,000. Yeah, so it feels like 10 because you know everyone for sure. But I grew up there. So golf was kind of the escape in the summer. There's just not as much to do. So I ended up just going to the golf course every day and basically living at the golf course. But as I grew in my golf game, I started to golf more in the Belleville area at Trillium Woods, actually, and then playing the kind of small Kingston circuit. So at the time, like, I didn't know going to university in the States for golf at all was a possibility, or I just thought, oh, I like golf, it's kind of fun. And then as soon as I actually played in that St. Lawrence Tour in Kingston, you quickly realize based on so-and-so is 2 years older, 5 years older, they went to this school, they did this. And it gives you this like aspiration that you might be able to do it. And literally probably 2 years before I went to school in the States, I never thought it would ever be possible that I could go to the school in the States to play golf.
Was that because like this small town living, or was it just literally you'd even think of that as like something you wanted to do?
Oh, I didn't even know it was like a possibility.
Yeah.
Like golf to me was like, oh, it's great. Like there's the pros, but then the in-between stages as like a small town Canadian, it was super confusing. And then once you talk to people in Kingston who kind of had done it, it was quick to realize like, oh, this is actually a possibility if you like work hard enough for it.
But you didn't just play golf growing up either, right? Like you played hockey, you know, I believe played junior hockey, all those different sports.
For sure.
Did that possibly play a part in that? Like you just weren't so, you know, it feels like nowadays we can go into this whole specialization versus mm-hmm. generalist conversation if you want. But yeah. Like nowadays, it's almost like these parents put their kids in this one sport at a certain age so they can specialize at the Tiger Woods model, where you mm-hmm. just kind of were an athlete that just played everything, right?
Yeah, totally. I read, I think it was the Tiger Woods book or a different book about specialization. And I'm like a super firm believer in the opposite.
Yeah, me too.
Do more and, so for me, like playing golf was great for like understanding how to play on a team. And then playing hockey. And then surprisingly going to the States, golf there at university, it actually leans closer to it's individual, but you're on a team and you have to play like you're on a team at times. So you have to be like more conservative if someone else is struggling. It really changes the dynamic. But yeah, and I don't know if people realize this, and you kind of see it in the pros, where people get like burnt out and struggle. So I played Div 1 golf in the States, and every summer, I didn't tell my coach at the time, but I didn't golf. Like I didn't get a membership. I would go to the golf course twice a week and hit range balls, because in the summers, like I didn't want to play golf. I didn't enjoy golf. I loved every second I was at university playing competitive golf. But by the end of the season, I was so tired that summer period for me was actually just a break from golf. I could work and I could like think differently. And then the week or 2 weeks before going back to the States to play golf, I practiced and played every single day and practiced so hard and went back. And I think I was better for it because I took time off and I did other sports. I swam, I did all kinds of stuff. Whereas if I was so just golf, 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 I think I would have not enjoyed it nearly as much at university. Whereas I loved like every second of it.
Yeah. And there's two things. So you talk about this book, like I'm reading Range by, I believe it's David Epstein.
That's the book. Yeah.
And they really talk about the differences of like the Tiger Woods model versus Nadal model and Federer mm-hmm. and how they played all these different sports and they still got there. And once they got there, you know, compared to their peers, they went on a different trajectory. But once they didn't, he didn't specialize till late in life. And you look at Tiger Woods, where there's more, like there's less Tiger Woods that specialize early that end up being successful compared to the generalist.
Yeah.
Right. And I think what you're talking about too, and it just random thought, we're talking about like the team sport aspect, right, coming into play. I wonder if those people that do struggle with, you know, college golf and the ability of teams, like I first thought I think of is Patrick Reed, right? Like you hear all the stories, nobody liked him on his team at college, like all those different stories. He had to leave, go to multiple different schools. Like, I wonder if he even played team sports growing up, if that had an aspect of like not even being able to recognize like, hey, this isn't just about me, it's about we.
Right. Yeah, no, and you say, you can kind of say the same thing probably about Tiger Woods in many aspects.
Look, like, yeah, his life. Yeah, that's a great call.
Like,
yeah.
Everything about his life was just like, do it for myself to like exceed expectations and just like succeed all the way through. Or yeah, you see it for sure in college golf. You get a lot of people who do see it as an individual game sport. And I think the best college golfers in what I would call like the mid tier, there's like the ones who are going professional and it's just like a different level. But in that mid tier, if you have someone who shoots between 70 and 75 every round, like that's an excellent teammate on a college golf team. And I'd way rather have them than someone who's like 68 to 84, like that range. If someone's really tight and consistent, that's like a better teammate often. Whereas yeah, like Patrick Reed, I don't know. He's obviously a great golfer, but in college, did he ever have times where he just like quit, like threw in the towel? Because if you're a good teammate, you can't do that in college golf. You like have to grind it out.
So what were you then? Like looking back at it, were you that mid-tier? Like where were you as a college golfer?
Yeah, I was for sure my first year, I wasn't that good at golf, I would say. I got a lot better, but I was very consistent. And I never really went low. I think my lowest actually was 67, which was really good. Great. But otherwise, I would always shoot like 74, 75. I wasn't like that incredible as far as like hitting it far. I would just kind of score a decent score and place like top 30 in a tournament and then just move on. So on our team, I always played. I think I was like, when I was first year, I basically fought to get like a five spot, which only five players play. And then in my last year, I was always second. I was always the number two spot. So I would just kind of like place a number and move on. But yeah, I wish actually I could shoot low scores. I think in Canada, it's a bit different than if you're from, say, the South or the States, you play all year round. I think they play like up tees at times to like understand the feeling of shooting a really low score. Whereas in Canada, we're always like pushing ourselves to play like the back tees.
Yeah.
So like I'm grinding to shoot like an 85 when I should be playing like the reds to shoot like 65.
So you know how to get into that, like in that mode of what being low is and mentally grinding through, oh, I'm minus four right now. I've never been there before. Like that's what, like a theory that they were teaching in the States that you didn't see being taught up here. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's in the States. I haven't actually heard anyone like talk about it.
I've never heard somebody ever bring that up because I think that's a really smart idea.
Yeah, I think it's more common in the States where you have more time to play golf, right? So you're like trying different things. Whereas in Canada, you have like 3 months or however many months long. So you play every round, like it's a tournament round sort of. So yeah, no, I never really did that until in school we do where you play like a certain tee deck or even things like where you have three clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Like we would mix that into practice every once in a while. And that was like, at first it was kind of confusing and hard, but then after a while it made like you way more creative in what you could do. So I think golf practice and play, you can kind of combine the two, but making sure it's like unique every time is useful. Whereas if you just practice, I don't think you're going to get a good swing and everything, but actually translating that to the course, it's hard. But if you also just play, and just play like 18 hole serious rounds, you might not be able to get into like a different groove or like a different mental state. So I think it's kind of a combo of the two.
So when you're playing college golf, you know, you're that second best player. Were you always realistic about what golf was? Like we all know the guy that, you know, in college, he's shooting low 70s, but believes he's going to have a career as a pro. And sometimes it happens. Like you look at an Ian Poulter that turned pro at a four handicap, right? There's many, you know, guys that were playing Div 2 college that somehow went on to have pro careers. But like for you, did you know, you know, once I'm done school, this is the end of me trying to be real competitive in this sport?
Yeah, for sure. And even like before I went to university, I had the same mindset. Like I always wanted to go to university and do business, and going to school, I was as like a business minded person. I was like, oh, this is a way for me to actually pay less for university and get just as good of education and hopefully get this like really good experience and enjoy myself. So I use it as like a great way to get more school paid for. And when I was there, there was definitely people on my team who wanted to take that step to like become a pro. And it's so hard to see someone on the same team I'm on, I'm say in the number two spot, and they're like grinding it out to maybe make the five spot, maybe make the team, yet they still have the attitude of like, I think I can go pro after this. So I think I've told people this, where if there's certain people who really have it, and then there's also people who can really work hard to get there, but then there's this mindset of millions of people probably in the States or around the world where they think they're good enough to make it. So golf tournaments, there's like a certain number who can attend each golf tournament. So if there's like 1,000 people who think they can make it, who are all trying to make it, and you're like the one who actually has the talent, for you to make it through that like crowd of people, just because on one day or 2 or 3 days in a tournament, someone who's like almost good enough can actually beat you. And instead of you competing like one-on-one with someone else who's like not as good as you, you're competing against 1,000 people who aren't as good as you, yet one of them could have a good day and be better than you. So for me, golf of all sports is probably the one where people get weeded out the slowest. So it makes it later on in the pro level so hard to make it. Whereas if you're playing basketball, I think you get weeded out fairly quick, or like other sports, like hockey. Hockey's a great one where you get weeded out pretty quickly if you don't make it to a certain league or level. Whereas golf, you had the weeding out process is like, you could go to like a Div 1 school that's not as good. You go to Div 2 school, but you still think you have an opportunity to make it as a pro.
Yeah. And I wonder, because it's such that individual level where you still are playing with yourself, and there's, you know, like we look at other sport, like a tennis, right? It's still an individual sport, right? But there's a certain aspect where you will get to face a certain person, and right, it doesn't matter how many times you play them, you're not beating them, right? Where, you know, right, as a golfer, you go to a certain golf course, and there are times where you'll beat that golf course better than you've ever beat that golf course before, which then right, puts this mental spin into yeah, you, where it's like, oh, I shot 68. Oh, like I'm comparing it, whether I like it or not, to John Rahm, who just shot 68 on the right, weekend, right? There's no other sport that I can think of where there's that, you can almost go into a parallel with somebody you're watching on TV and compare yourself to it based on a number that is on the screen versus everything else you actually see. Right.
Yeah. And you can do it too. Like in college, we played at the golf course there on the West Coast. Oh, I can't think of the name right now, where Tiger missed the cut. He shot like 85 or something. Chambers Bay. So we had a tournament at Chambers Bay in my last year of university. And I shot probably the best round of my entire life. I shot, I think it was 72, and it was windy, it was rainy, it was a crummy day. The golf course was ridiculously long, but I beat it was the number one amateur in the world that day. I beat it by like 3 shots, and I'm like, that's crazy. And then Tiger Woods goes, plays the tournament 2 months later. Shoots like 84. I'm like, I think I could be a professional. But it was like, I had the best round of my entire life, played out of my shoes, and still like, you can't compare in different ways. Yeah. I think actually a good comparison of golf and this conversation is TikTok probably. TikTok, anyone could potentially go viral. So you're like, ooh, I could go viral. I could be this big hit. So you're always like trying, because there's that just one potential. So it's like, oh, I'm going to enter this tournament because I could have a good day. I could make it. But there's no like door closing where it's like, you're not going to go viral. Like, just stop, just quit trying. You always have like in the back of your mind, I could make it. I could do this.
Because you've seen somebody else that's been in your shoes do that exact same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I've never even thought of that analogy. I think that's really good. And I mean, we'll wrap up your college stuff and then we'll get to the business, because I think there's a lot of ties here of what I talked about on this podcast a lot with golf being a little bit of a business that's stuck in old ways. So we'll get to that in a sec. But I want, like, because I know you're passionate about still, like, even if you know you're not going to be a pro or this is the end, you know, the college golf is your Stanley Cup or is your green jacket, right? Even getting there is the win, the final win. Like, how what advice do you give to these other Canadian kids that are like, they're that's what they want to do, like, or maybe they're unsure, like what would you tell them from that kid, that small town kid in Tweed, you know, going to the big city, because you went to New York, right?
Yeah just outside. So the I guess golf in general, it's like a good sport to pick up and learn. Is to me what it does is it teaches you a lot of lessons. So if you really get into golf and get committed as like a young person, you want to play golf, it teaches you first off, like, you can aspire to be something. So that's like just a good lesson on its own, just to see like, oh, there's the pros, what can I do to get there? So for me, I like learn the steps later on, but it also teaches you to be very diligent. So you like practice, and to get better, you know, you have to do these things and you get pretty obsessed with it, which I think is just a good skill. And then the other skill I would say that's kind of different is more on like the business world. I think what golf teaches you, and it's kind of going to sound funny, but it teaches you like about A/B testing. So, okay, how can I be creative and change something? So it teaches you like life lessons around, okay, this summer or winter, I'm going to overhaul my entire swing because I think the rewards will be better. So you can actually go through that mental process of, okay, I'm going to do this, but here's what I think I'll get. And then you'll go through the pain to get there, which in like the business world, if your business is struggling, you might be like, I'm going to re-overhaul the entire business, change it. And here's what I'm going to try to come. So it helps you like set those timelines. And then also if you're like, oh, I want to learn how to hit a cut, you get to like learn how to like progressively do things and understand them. So it gives you this like incredible patience, which I think as like a sport, it's pretty good.
That's really cool. I actually thought about that. And like, cause like, you know, when you do make a big swing change in golf, similar to making a big, say, you know, and we'll get to Bush Bomb in a second. Bush Bomb did a huge, at one point, realized who their actual market was from what the market used to be, right? Like, it's a huge change and a risky potential change, where in golf, you know, you make this big swing change and you know, for the next, say, 6 months, your scores are going worse. They're not getting better day one, right? Same thing with business. It's like, I am projecting because I make this change, right? This is what's going to happen. Did golf teach you something about like the pain, like how to deal with those pain of during the change process that now you're still using, you know, day to day, like even if with subconsciously of like just being, you know, able to take on that burden, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know, actually. I think just in general, being like patient. So like me before golf, like I started golf when I was, I think I was 12. Mm-hmm. I started golf late. And if you look at me as like a human before golf and after golf, I was like way more temperamental. And like, I would get kind of swear and fight and like be all after my brothers, all these things. And then after golf, I got very like soft-spoken. I slowed down a lot. So it just made me a person that's almost like just walking at a golf course, right? You're just very calm, collected. Whereas before golf, I was very like hockey mindset, where I was like, go, go, go. So it changed me just over those like years. And maybe it was something different, but I attribute a lot of it to golf.
No, I think it's really cool. Like knowing, hey, for me to be successful in this sport, I need to have this type of temperament. And then seeing, okay, that temperament works in golf. How can that work in other areas of life, like business per se?
Right, for sure.
So let's talk about your business. Obviously, Bush Bomb, flashy name. What is Bush Bomb for people that don't know? And let's give like the original origins, and then we'll talk about, you know, why I wanted to have you come on just to discuss the idea of Bush Bomb and how it relates to the golf industry in a very loose, intertwined way. I'm going to figure out a way to connect these two.
Yeah. So Bush Bomb, we're a skincare brand at heart. And our mission is to solve common skin concerns that we believe, say, the beauty industry has ignored. So think ingrown hairs, dark spots, razor burn, skin conditions like that. And most of them revolve around hair removal or trimming, shaving, waxing is a big category for us. So we have quite a few products. We've got ingrown hair products. We have a dark spot oil. It's really popular. And then we have an electric trimmer. So we launched it last year and it's been a pretty big hit for us. And the business is, we're located out of Ottawa, which is kind of interesting. It's like a Canadian government town and we have this pubic skincare company. So we're out of Ottawa. We have a team now of about 10. And as far as the founding story, it all started with the two other co-founders, Tim and Mel, on their honeymoon. Tim took his or her face oil and he put it down there to freshen up. And then that started just the conversation of like, what could skincare down there actually be? So it sounds, a lot of people look at our business and they think that's cute, like Bush Bomb, very niche.
Yeah, like shock value, but it's not, right?
Yeah.
Like that's not.
But yeah, if you break it down, it's like who shaves almost everyone. And it's like, oh, who gets razor burn or ingrown hair? It's like, well, a lot of people. So it's actually a big market. Even for us now, we focus mostly women who shave, wax, or sugar. That's kind of our sweet spot. But in the future, I'm sure we'll have many products for men. We're just, it's just not our target audience right now.
For sure. But even at one point, though, it was, right? If you look back the origin story, like Tim was like, hey, if I throw this down there, I'm going to smell good, right? Oh, this is a product. Let's do this. Let's go with that shock value. Where now I still think you guys have this rebellious way about the way you run your business. And like the photos that you'll show on your business page aren't the photos that other beauty companies would necessarily show.
Yeah. And that's one of our values is early on, actually, we went to an Etsy craft show to talk to people and people were kind of offended at times. They'd be like, oh, that's offensive. And now what we realized is like, no, it's actually our values is we want to destigmatize people talking about like razor burn, ingrown hairs, their pubic hair. Like we want people to be able to do whatever they want down there and have no one like look down upon them for having ingrown hairs or having like a hairy armpit. Those are things that we're trying to destigmatize and have it just more common language. Because if no one talks about it, no one knows what products exist. So our purpose is like, hey, let's just make sure people know it's fine to talk about these. And then people will discover the products that work best for them.
And you nailed the wording on like the don't look down upon, because that's why this is exactly what I wanted to bring you on. We could talk about Bush Bomb, but you know, we are a golf podcast. You have golf industry experience and you have this business experience where it's like, let's change this industry that is long overdue for a change. And I am of the belief, you can hear me on this podcast say all the time, that the golf industry is so stuck in these old ways and is so afraid of change. And that is the thing of like, how can we bring more people in? And it's really this like looking down upon. So if you look at the golf business, like what areas do you see from somebody that, you know, is a little bit of a rebel in the beauty business that like the golf business needs to change, whether it's the product side, the golf club side, like what areas or gaps are you seeing?
I guess on the side of change, I think there's more that can be done, especially to bring new people in. And I think the pandemic was probably a great example of it, like forced new people to come to golf, which was great. But I think in general, like certain, especially public courses, could do a different approach to bring more people to golf. So if you see in the States, this is far more apparent where like there's no dress code for many golf courses and it's fine. Like they just want people to golf, enjoy themselves and go home. Like that's just the approach there in many states, but also different golf courses in the States do like Thursday night is blah, whatever it is. It's like a deal, but it's also like themed of some sort, or there's like a game of some sort. So it's more approachable. It's like bring yourself, bring someone who doesn't golf at all. So I think there can be more there. But then also places like Top Golf in general have made it like way more approachable. And I thought Top Golf was gonna be super expensive. It's still expensive, but it wasn't as it's much cheaper than taking someone out for a round, for
instance. Oh yeah.
He goes like four people. So that's one thing. And then on the other side though is I think golf also just gets a bad rep.
Okay.
And that's, you might disagree with that, but I think if you look at like private clubs at times, there's like for sure some stuffiness in ways, but also like deep down, you like get to know people and talk to them and you see, oh no, this is actually like people will pay for a community that will help them. And that's kind of what it becomes. It's similar to like a tennis club or like a curling club. You get like a community around you that become your best friends and your community. And I think that in itself gets a bad rep because people like pay for community and then community gets like a different tainted look on it. Anyways, I think there's a bad rep there. And then I think definitely we need more people to play golf, which private clubs certainly don't help that.
Well, I like this angle because it's like, I agree with you. Once you're actually in, there is very much a community, especially at these private clubs. But the gatekeeper, right? That almost makes it where it's like there's a fence there, there's a door there. You're not allowed in. If you get in, oh well, like we're so welcoming. Like where are we going wrong at that point where we need to open the door, that gate, so more people actually realize, hey, this is a great community to be a part of.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. It's actually really hard. It's like a supply and demand thing as well too now.
Yeah.
So if you look at like certain clubs and how many people can join, and I know right now at the Hunt Club, there's like a waiting list for, I think every group actually, from like intermediate members to fully privileged members, there's actually like a full on wait list. So now it's like, okay, we have a supply and demand issue on that side of it. I don't know what changes. Cause yeah, at my course, you have to have like a referral, refer you in, all things like that. But when I was a member at Trillium Woods in Belleville, it's semi-private, I think would be the classification. And it was so approachable and great to bring people in. So I personally love the model of like a Trillium Woods. It has like a massive driving range and practice area, but then also it's like a semi-private club. The only downfall is if you're a member there, at times it can get really busy. So you like lose a bit of that. Whereas with the private club, you do typically have like good pace of play, like all those things go up. I don't know. I wish I had a solution. I actually don't.
I agree with you on not having. I think there's these little things of just being approachable and showing that you're open to new people coming in. Like I think of any golf course right now. I'll give you Trillium Woods, for example. Is there a sign that says, here's where to go for the pro shop, you know, take this to the driving? There isn't those signs at the golf course. Like you get in the parking lot, you get your clubs out at, I'm going to say 98% of golf courses, you get your clubs out and now you're standing there and you're like, I'll just follow this direction because I saw someone going in that direction. Like, it seems like such a small thing because you and I, we've gone every golf course, we can figure it out. Right. But for a newbie, it's like, I don't know where the driving range, what is a driving range? Like they don't understand that process.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And obviously as you go to like more private clubs, the signage gets less and less.
Oh yeah.
Cause you're like, you're meant to golf there every day. You know, everything. There's no like,
they don't even want people to know there's a golf course there. Right? Like there's certain golf courses where like it's a gate, but it doesn't say what the gate's for.
Right. Yeah, no, totally.
I know you don't have a solution, but I'm going to make you come up with one solution here. So what you've highlighted as Bush Bomb, and this is what I love about you, it's like everybody's welcome. We're going to show every different type of body, right? And celebrate it. How can golf do that? How can they show every different type of golfer, bring more golfers in and celebrate every different type of golfer from the low end to the high end? What can people start doing in your mind to take that Bush Bomb approach?
Huh? No, that's a good point. I think someone said this once, which would be funny and relatable, is have just like the average golfer play like a course at the same time or a different time than the pros. I think that would just be cool to watch. how do you make it more approachable and celebrate more of everyone? It really is. It's really hard to even think of that because like golf really only values or shows value to like the best, right?
You look at a club like Titleist comes out with a new driver, right? Who's on the commercial? Adam Scott.
Yeah.
Because he's ridiculously good looking, has the best golf swing of all time. Like, why can't we have David Gaylord, who, I mean, you're a pretty good golfer. You know, your girlfriend hitting golf balls with the new driver, right? Like, why can't we show those type of things? Like, I think even like those small things might be better in the long run.
Yeah, no, totally. Or even just like different golf clubs. That's one thing no one really talks about either. It's just like giving people different tools that are different. And I don't know what that looks like, but it, like for the average golfer, you don't have to strive to buy the best. You can really like, there's a certain level of club, or maybe it's a different style of club, the way it looks, I don't know, but like making it more approachable from that end might be useful. Or like even a set, like if you're just starting golf, you probably need a driver and then one iron and a putter. Like you don't even really need the full set. And like, it's not going to make you perfect and the best golfer, but at the same time, you don't have to spend all of a sudden $500. You spend $65 or whatever it is to have these three clubs. I think stuff like that makes it more just approachable in general. But yeah, I don't know. There is an element of like aspiration. So I don't know what, seeing me hit the ball in the range probably wouldn't aspire to.
I do think you've got my brain thinking is that like all we ever showcase is the top of the top, where the brands that bring people in the most, at least in the world that, you know, we're used to right now in this new entrepreneurial world where it's like anybody can be a small business owner, is normal people. It's not like the top of the beauty anymore. Like it's the world we're going to, is showing normal people doing things and how everybody looks different. That's something like we clearly don't have answers, but if it's up to me, like that's something I think golf needs to be doing in order to get more bodies into the game from all walks of life.
Yeah, for sure. And even actually one thing that would be, I think you see it more and more. You see a lot of like pros do lessons online or YouTube or Instagram, whatever, where they're just like, it's a lesson with someone who like isn't a professional or isn't. I think those are super valuable. Whereas you always see like a pro doing a lesson by themselves and the pro is like perfectly doing everything.
Oh, of course.
And you're like, they're showing me this thing. Whereas seeing a lesson of like someone who has a slice and they're an amateur that they've had this huge slice, that like that lesson to me is better seeing the actual person than seeing a pro like you'd probably do this and then doing it. I think that's like a more approachable way, because you can see, oh okay, I do that too, like let me relate to this individual person.
Yeah, club testing, all of that. I think, yeah, you're on some. All right, I got one more question. We'll let you out here. I come to you and I say, Busch Bomb this year needs to make a golf product. What is Busch Bomb going to do that is related to the golf industry? You have no choice. You gun to your head. What are you making?
Well, we're probably going to do it anyway. It's just like a hat. That's an easy one. We already have a towel.
Golf towel? Busch Bomb golf towel.
We already have a towel. I don't know what else we could do. Definitely a hat, though. I think a Busch Bomb hat would be quite a golf staple people would have.
So if anybody wants to buy Busch Bomb products, where can they check them out?
Yeah, if you're in the US, bushbomb.com. And then if you're in Canada, bushbomb.ca. And yeah, we have actually the same product line. Or actually, if you're in Canada, we're in Indigo now. And Canada and the US, we're in Indigo and Urban Outfitters.
Nice. Well, Dave, we really appreciate you coming on. Hopefully we get to play some golf together this summer. It's been a few years since we were able to do that. I know there's been this invite to Hunt Club that just never seems to actually be a real invite. So hopefully this year I can take you up on that. I really appreciate you coming on, and make sure you go and check out some Busch Bomb products.
Yeah, right on. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Thank you, David, again for that interview. Always nice to chat with a good friend. Great golfer. He talked about just, you know, being steady on the golf course. And that's still it. I play with him. It's just like just boring 75s or like I know he got really good last year. He was getting, you know, saw some scores in the 60s. Not bad for a guy that's running a business for the first time where he's quit his jobs and this is all he does. But great golfer. From Tweed, Ontario.
Yeah, I can remember him as a junior playing the junior circuit, and he was always pretty steady, always in the mix as far as trophies and things like that. And he's always been that way, though, that you knew he would do something. So it's good to see his success so far, for sure.
Just an absolute, I love the guy, but like so smart, but like a real space cadet, like the perfect definition of a space cadet. Him and my other buddy, Tim, who started Bush Bomb, like two of the smartest people ever, go to them for great advice. But like the most simplest thing, like Tim and I used to room together at times, like how to open a hotel door. Like Tim would struggle with like his keys, like just like these simple things.
That's amazing. Like,
so smart, but just, you know, if his head wasn't attached to his body, they might lose it. So love both those guys. And I see them go out. And for a lot of our listeners, we obviously have a big male listeners, like use, if you have a beard, great stuff to use as like beard oil, things along those lines. So their products are great. And look out for some hats this summer, as you said, that might be, might look good on the golf course. Not a lot to get into the rest of the week. We got to make our picks for the tournament I hate the most all year.
I know.
AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am, Scotty.
This one's a tough one always to pick because it's just, oh, it's so random, man. So
yeah, it is. And like, I'm looking, I'm not actually picking a second year player, but I did say this last week where I said, look out for a second year player to have a really good week at the AT&T. And the reason I said that is just the thought of like the first year, there's so many celebrities around. You're going to be, you know, a little bit overwhelmed and everything, but, this year, watch it. I don't have a list. I actually do have my pick for it. If you're, I believe I'm due.
We were both zeros last week, so you're
true. That hurt.
You still have the tea.
I wrote that article last week that, you know, I thought Bryson would have a really good week and come out. Matt Hughes, same thing, come out firing. Both of them just have tough first 2 days, missed the cut. And again, this is those weird weeks where the draw plays a big part.
With these multiple
course tournaments. That being said, this guy that I'm picking this week, you don't get lucky on the draw for 5-6 years in a row. So starting in 2014, this player finished T4, and then they finished T11.
Ooh.
And then they finished T5.
Wow.
And then they finished T2. And then they finish T4, and then they finish fourth. And then last year they finished, hold on, seventh. Do you know who this player is?
No, but man, they are an ATM at Pebble Beach.
They are. And they had a great week, almost a resurgence of sorts last week. A player that I love watching their golf swing. Unfortunately, didn't get done on Sunday when they were leading going into Sunday. I'm going with Jason Day.
Wow.
Jason Day is on this stretch right now at Pebble Beach that he's got to pick up a win. I think it was so awesome to see Jason Day in the mix. He's such an easy guy to root for. So nice. The weirdest part for me was when they showed his family on behind the green and Dash being like a
huge. Yeah,
exactly. I was like, what? That's his older. Cause I remember him running around with like the long hair on the greens after the win. They just had two kids. Now they got four.
Yeah.
And he's just this like massive dude.
Yeah. Like, when did you get the linebacker?
it threw me for a complete loop that I was shocked. I was like, that doesn't make sense, but I guess it does, like considering that, looking back. So Jason Day is my pick for the week. Who's yours?
Yeah, I really like that pick. I mean, you know, he's done a lot of work with Chris Como, changing his motion to be a little easier on his body. I mean, I can't fault that pick for sure. Damn it, you picked that one. You know what? I'm a little afraid with this tournament to kind of go with somebody who's a bigger name, just because there is tends to be some randomness with this tournament. And look at us last week. I mean, you know, Bryson and Max and, you know, nothing out of those guys. But I think Pebble is a little bit more random. So I'm going to try to go for a pick where I can at least make some money. And I'm going to take a player that I probably wouldn't take the rest of the year, and I'm just going to throw it out there. I'm going to take Troy Merritt, two-time winner on tour, mid-30s, tends to be steady at this event. You know, he's been T8, T25, T20, or T16 in his last three appearances. So pretty steady, likes this event. I'll call him a social guy. I mean, he doesn't mind the pro-am aspect of it. Actually had a chat with him a few years ago in the lobby at the MGM Grand, believe it or not, just a casual, you know, chat. And he wasn't one of those guys that kind of runs away. So I think he's comfortable in this environment, and he started the year with a couple of top 25 finishes. So I think he's swinging well. and hopefully make some money, because man, zeros hurt.
Yeah, it's gonna be someone like that. I was thinking of Brian Harman. Turns out this guy never plays in this tournament except for last year, because this guy doesn't like talking to people too much either. But just looking at Brian Harman's profile picture on PGA Tour website, they are doing this guy dirty. He had not accepted he was bald yet, and it's just like the stubbly up top with a little bit longer on the sides, very Jason Alexander pre plugs. Like, help this guy out. He's shaved the head, he's got a good beard going. Like, give him an updated photo. You can't be doing him dirty like this.
Or at least give them advance notice before they show up an event and going, hey, you know what? You're in the photo queue for this week. What do you mean this week? I mean, in 5 minutes. What?
Yeah, now, like, we need you to get in there. I've also never seen a number on the website that I think might be more accurate. Like, we've talked about this before on here, where we go over the player's height and weight, which we probably shouldn't. And we're like, is this accurate? Like, are you taking the over or under on this? 5'7", 150 for Brian Harman, like, is probably as close to perfect as you might get. 150 might be like a push on the high end. Like, they might be trying to help him out a little bit.
True. He's a tiny dude, that's for sure. Yeah. But he seems to get it done, that's for sure.
But yeah, the leaderboard this week, I think you're right on track. I think it's going to be somebody like that. Maybe this is the week Cameron Tringali gets it done and gets in there. He's been playing well.
He has.
Of late. I did not realize he was 35.
Like, you just thought he was younger or older?
Yeah, like, I mean, he's obviously the guy with the most money made without actually picking up a win. I just thought he was younger for some reason.
Yeah,
but like, for you to get that title, you can't be a young buck unless you're finishing second every week. It was just kind of a shock that he was a little bit older. He's almost like right there with Jason Day. Like, how old is Jason Day? He can't be much older than 35 too. No,
a little bit older than that now. I mean,
34. He's 34. Yeah. He's older than Jason Day. What is crazy, crazy stuff. But yeah, we got this silly tournament this week. I've been writing those little articles, things I'll be watching for. And I think I'm going the opposite. I think I'm going things I won't be wishing I get to see from this tournament.
They'll probably all come true.
Oh yeah, it's all gonna come true. But always nice to watch on Sunday. That's probably when I'll tune in the most. Yeah. Get to watch Pebble Beach at least once a year. It's unfortunate because those other two golf courses are so good, but the coverage just never holds up the same way as it does at Pebble Beach.
No, it's hard, and we don't get the shot tracing and things like that early in the week, so that makes it a little bit harder. Definitely, you know, another week where we see some players still testing other equipment and stuff like that. Should note that on the Flagstick Twitter, I've been pushing out a few of the what's in the bags for the Canadians. Our buddy Greg Moore, who does all the photography for golfwrx.com, sent me a message last night, and he'd done Svensson, Hadwin, and Hughes had their bags. Last week he had Gligic up or whatever, and he said he's going to grab the rest of the Canadians for us as well, and so we can get that up there.
Nice, love it. Cool. Why don't we hit the mailbag and we'll get out of here for the week.
All right, let's get to it. How do I convince my uncle to replace his 1991 era Big Bertha driver?
Sounds like a good driver, but I think what you got to do is let him hit one right beside each other on your golf course. You grab your club, grab his Big Bertha, same ball, let him hit both and see if he can outdo it. He should be able to hit it further. But, you know, what's he like as a golfer? Does he even care? Because if not, then who cares? Let him have his 1991 Big Bertha driver.
Yeah, that's where I'm at with this. I mean, convincing your uncle, is it convincing him because you think he should have it? Or, I mean, this guy could maybe play, you know, two times a summer. Who knows, right? And doesn't really want to put the money into it. Maybe he loves that driver. He thinks he hits it well. Maybe it was fitted back then. Maybe he's got an emotional tie to it or whatever. And really, maybe he doesn't care about 10 yards, if that's the case as far as the gain.
Can you imagine it was only 10 yards, like 30 years later? You know, like, it could be. Like, that would be pretty tough to see.
did you see the test that our buddy Ryan Brath and Ian Fraser did on TXG with the
slider?
With the slider and the stealth. And you, a lot of it comes down to fitting, right? When you're going through and doing things. And I mean, you know, it's not to say that modern clubs are not necessarily better. Obviously, manufacturers, you know, chase different things for them, but they're not necessarily always going to be better for everyone. So there could be certain things or certain characteristics of another club, just because the year that it was made or the name that's on it, that doesn't really matter as much as getting it fitted for you properly. So, you know, maybe this is good for Uncle, whatever his name is.
Uncle Dave.
Sure. So, you know, you can convince him, just like Stefan said, you know, put something next to it, have him hit it. If he hits it better, chances are he's going to decide for himself that he's going to go, man, I want those free yards. So,
or you just run it over with the car if you really care that much. Yeah. Just, oh, oops, I ran over your golf bag with the car. Whoops.
Just sell it off on eBay for $7 and he won't.
There you go.
All right. I like to look at PGA Tour equipment. How does a website like Golf WRX get all those what's in the bag photos? I think I just answered that. Actually.
Hey, you know the guy.
Yeah. So Greg Moore, who is a PGA of America Class A professional into photography. He started doing those years and years ago. I've known Greg, God, 15 years, I guess now at least. And he's the guy who goes out, goes to the events. The reason why he gets access, and this is really the big question more than anything, is he's built a relationship with the players. He's built a relationship with the manufacturers. If they have something that they don't want to be seen, they'll let him know. He doesn't break those, you know, agreements or whatever the case may be. And excuse me, as a result of it, they allow him to dig through their bag. They're used to seeing him on the range. He'll pull out all their clubs, have all the close-up shots, do all the things. And as a result of it, there's some cool stuff. I mean, I mentioned the Mackenzie Hughes bag. Just go and look at his putter, just, you know, to see his center shafted ping putter and all the lead tape on it and those close-up photos. It's pretty cool to see. And it's interesting to see how a player just stays so faithful to a putter that they've, you know, obviously had some success with.
Yeah. He's always been a center shaft putter, right? Like like, I remember David Byrne tweeted about losing to him junior golf and he had a centered shafted putter way back then. Like just, it's the look, not for me, but for Mac, who's, you know, one of the best putters on tour, yep. It works for him, but yeah, I love what's in the bags. It's and some of them don't even change. And I love when we even go further and you see it at the time when you're at events, you know, hey, can I get a quick photo of the bag, take the head covers off, do whatever. It's cool. I think it's one of the best things for us gear nerds.
Yeah. I think what's neat too is when, you know, like last week for sure, you know, some of the Amex photos of Gligic's bag, you get players that are in mixed bag situations and they're testing. So people will look and they're like, man, that guy's got 20 clubs in there. He's got all sorts of different woods. They're trying different things as opposed to, you know, a single manufacturer player who's, you know, just playing those particular clubs from that particular brand. It's probably more interesting to see, you know, when a player has a choice from an agnostic basis, just to pick out the clubs that work best for them. That's when it becomes really fascinating to see what they put in their bags.
I agree.
All right. Speaking of putting, and this is the question you alluded to earlier. If you could have one pro golfer putt for you, who would it be?
So I made a joke that like Will Zalatoris would be a great one because you would actually see like great improvements. Like you would be better. Like, there's not a chance you're a better putter than Will Zalatoris. I don't care who's listening to this outside of maybe a couple of the guys that are out on PGA Tour right now that sometimes do listen to this podcast. Hi to those folks. but even this person, they would rather... they are putting for them. And that is Imbie Park. If I'm going to have anyone putt for me, I'm going to take arguably the best putter of all time, regardless of gender. And it's Imbie Park. There were some great stats that came out last year. We talked about it. Yeah. So I'm taking Imbie. Stolen. I know you probably wanted it, so you can pick somebody else.
I will have to. And you're right. When those KPMG insights came out, obviously, they proved that, you know, she was fantastic. Recent announcement, actually, just in the last couple of hours here, KPG has announced they've got a new dashboard for the players, particularly. Now, we get the raw data as media. I've been digging through that a little bit. They'll send out spreadsheets with all sorts of different things. A little harder to disseminate the information. But then now what they've done with KPMG is they've created dashboards, individual ones for the players, so they can analyze round to round where they're doing, you know, well and where they're doing poorly. So that's going to be really helpful. Obviously, every time you look at those charts, yeah, Imbie Park is going to be right up the top there as far as strokes gained putting. I will have to go then to kind of her counterpart over on the men's side, one of the leading players all time in strokes gained as far as putting is concerned, and a golf swing that everyone loves, but I think he's underrated as far as his putting, except, you know, when you've seen him in certain major championships, Louis Oosthuizen. You know, love his stroke, very efficient. If you look through all his numbers, very well balanced as far as a putter, no problem with the short stuff. Does well in the long stuff, makes more than he should in the middle, and just a joy to watch as well. So Louis is my guy there.
Who would you rather have putting for you between Will Zalatoros or Ernie Els?
Oh God. Wow. At what age?
Just now
would be a different story. I would take Will for sure. Obviously Ernie in his earlier days, if we took 1992 Ernie, who is, you know, brimming with confidence and winning an Open championship, yeah, I would have taken him then. He's got a lot of scar tissue by now, and I mean,
I still haven't got over that Masters.
Yeah.
And I think it was one of the first years where they did it where you can watch every single shot,
yeah,
on the website. And I remember going there and just watching that over and over. And the Masters did them dirty. It was literally, you could watch the seventh putt, the eighth putt, like, oh, so bad. That was his first hole of the tournament. And he was still at an age where he could have been in the mix. And you may as well just leave.
It takes a lot of discipline to put your brain back in. I mean, you know, not that I had that issue, but I can tell you from making a nine on the first hole of a tournament last year, yeah, it takes a lot to sit there and go, should I just go to the parking lot now? Because my odds of coming back are pretty slim, let alone doing that at a major championship on those surfaces, knowing that you have 17 more parking lots that you're going to have to putt on for the rest of the day. So, I mean, I can't even fathom that, let alone national TV. Fact that he's a major champion, the whole deal.
Yeah, you're gonna be on Sports Center forever.
Yeah,
like all those, and you're gonna have
guys
tens
on podcasts talking about, yeah, it forever. Yeah. All right, two more here. How do I get involved helping out at golf tournaments?
And the big ones, obviously, you can go on to and volunteer for them. But if anybody's going to tell you how to get to normal golf, the golf tournaments in your area, Scotty's your guy. So, Scotty, what do you know best? You know, let's speak about Ontario, for example. Yeah. Like, there's a ton in Ontario. What's the best way to get involved?
Yeah, the biggest thing is it comes down to the host courses more than anything. If you know that an event is happening at, you know, a golf course, say maybe an Ontario amateur or something's coming to your area, reach out to the golf course. They're going to have the connection with the committee, with the tournament director, whoever's running it. They're going to put you in touch with them. You know, on the other side of it, you know, you could go directly to the associations as well. So if you're in a particular area of the province, your district or whatever the case, reach out to them, reach out to Golf Canada. They can filter it down as well and let you know kind of who takes care of those things in certain areas. I don't know of a single tournament that is not always looking for people, short of, you know, sometimes you get oversubscribed for things like the Canadian Open, CP Women's Open, for an example. You know, they need a tremendous amount of volunteers, 1,400 to 1,700 in some cases. And you can reach out to those events in particular and get on the list for those. Sometimes there's a fee involved with those because they have uniforms and certain things. But, you know, the privileges that you get for that fee with your access to the tournaments and stuff is more than worth it. But I would say, you know, start at your local club as well. Reach out to your local club, wherever you play, maybe where you're a member. They have tournament committees too. They're always looking for help. So reach out there for starters. And who knows, from there, you could actually be working your way up through other committees and onto higher levels as far as helping out and whatever aspect that they need. All right, last one here. My friend recommended that I learn the game by starting on short courses and ignoring the driver. Well, we'd want to ignore the driver all the time, don't we? Is this a good approach? Some thoughts on that?
I always believe that the best way to learn the game is starting from the green and moving away from it. Yeah. And that there's so many things you learn from chipping and putting that go to every other aspect of the game. That's my thought. I approached it that way. I've said on this podcast, you know, coming out of school when university, when I had no money, right? Like I couldn't afford to hit golf balls every day, but the range let me go and chip and putt. So I just did that a lot, right? Mm-hmm. It taught me a whole bunch of stuff. It made it fun. You learn how to shape the golf ball a little bit differently just by having one club and getting a little bit more unique.
How's that going for you?
I don't get to play golf anymore. I think still though, to this day, like I'm super comfortable with a wedge in my hand. If there's anything that's, you know, the best part of my game, it's probably a wedge and the putter. But I think what we have learned though over the years is there is some data that might actually say the opposite, that being a great driver of a golf ball might actually be better. So coach, you have somebody new come to the game. What is your thoughts?
Yeah, I think although the data definitely supports as far as being able to drive it long gives you an advantage from a scoring, that only happens if you have the other aspects of your game, you know, taken care of as well. So I think you need to learn how to score. That's going to be a lot more. There's a lot greater myriad of shots around the green. So learning there first is certainly important, and then working your way back. I'm with that. The other thing as well is that, you know, from a confidence standpoint, with a driver, longer club, harder to make centered contact, less loft. So shots that you have a poor path and face relationship, for an example, your curves are going to be bigger with a driver than you are with irons. So it tends to be more defeating for people. So from a confidence standpoint, you start with a driver, you can make a decent swing and get a poor result. You can make that same decent swing with an iron and get a more acceptable result. And if you get destroyed by the driver right from the start, chances are you're not going to be all that excited to play the game. So if we're, you know, if we're talking about a younger person, a junior, anybody, you want confidence to kind of build your way up. And frankly, when I hang around and hit golf balls, I mean, I'm more than happy to go out and play a short course. I do it in the sim all the time. I play little short courses, par threes, irons only. In essence, you're probably only hitting a driver maybe 14 times in a regulation round of golf. It's important, yes, for sure. But all the other shots make up more for it. So great concept. Don't be shy about that. Especially if you've got juniors, great to see golf courses that have, you know, maybe tees that are 100 yards from the hole. And then you can just get used to that and start working your way back.
That was one of the coolest things I talked about with Dave in our conversation, was that this idea of like playing up a bunch of tees when you're a competitive golfer, so you get the feeling of being under par,
right,
and keeping it under par versus playing at that back tee because of your distance, mm-hmm. right? And just that feeling of being there. So when you actually are there from a tee that you're more normal, you're actually prepared mentally because you've actually been there before. And by playing these short courses and things like that, it actually might help that. Never actually heard somebody look at it that way and describe it that way. I thought it was really cool that a ton of like young junior players that are learning to play the game at that competitive level, something they could learn when, hey, they have all the time in the world. They're at the golf course all summer when their parents drop them off and they're playing 36 holes a day. Like,
yeah,
use that, experiment with the golf course. You don't have to play the same tee every single day, but using that as a way to get yourself into these positions. So a lot of different ways to look at it.
Getting comfortable going low is definitely important. I mean, we look how many players implode because they realize what their score is at.
Done it so many times.
Everybody's done it, yeah. Right? You just kind of get there and you're kind of like, oh, wishing it into the house. But as you said, you know, if you get comfortable with that, and you've said it before too, if you make too many birdies, then move back. So same thing in this case or whatever.
Never done that. I've never had a problem. It's but weird.
It would be a nice problem to have.
Yeah, it would be a nice problem. Never had that problem. Weird. I don't know why. Cool. Well, thank you everyone for sending in questions on the mailbag. We really appreciate it. Scotty, you're back to teaching this week. You looking forward to getting back in the cave, getting the students back in?
I am. And, you know, they're super eager as well. Obviously, a lot of people reaching out now and you know, especially after a prolonged break. So I think the first little bit is going to be a lot of people just knocking rust off, getting a few swings in, just getting a feel of, you know, standing on 2 feet and swinging a chunk of metal, which they haven't done in a little while, but certainly eager after the break to, you know, start planning out what the students are going to be doing, working towards their goals. You know, before we know it, the golf season is going to be here and, you know, they're going to have golf tournaments. We're already planning right now. I mean, talking to students, a lot of people are already planning out their schedules. Golf Ontario schedules out, Golf Canada, all sorts of different ones. So people are already planning
flagstick tournaments coming up.
Yep. So we'll have some more details on those soon. But yeah, people are already making those schedules. So definitely eager to get back and do some coaching.
For sure. Hopefully at some point, good to see you in person this week.
Yes. It's been,
damn, a couple months.
I know.
In a year.
It's crazy.
But yeah, we'll leave it at that. Thank you everyone for listening. We'll be back next week to break down the tournament that drives me nuts more than any other golf tournament, but it's at one of the most beautiful places on earth. So maybe I can find some solace in that. But Scotty, thank you so much. Listeners, thank you so much. We'll be back with you next week. We'll chat with you then. Mm-hmm.